From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Rosellen Brown, whose new novel is The Lake on Fire, published by Saraband. This is my second conversation with Rosellen Brown. We spoke early in the show's life, and you can find that on the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. Rosellen Brown has published widely in magazines, and her stories have appeared frequently in O. Henry Prize Stories, Best American Short Stories, and Pushcart Prizes. One is included in the bestseller Best Short Stories of the Century, edited by John Updike. She has been the recipient of an award in literature from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the Bunting Institute, the Howard Foundation, and twice from the National Endowment for the Arts, and was selected one of Ms. Magazine's 12 Women of the Year in 1984. Some Deaths in the Delta was a National Council on the Arts Prize selection, and Civil Wars won the Janet Kafka Prize for the best novel by an American woman in 1984. The Lake on Fire is an epic narrative that begins among 19th century Jewish immigrants on a failing Wisconsin farm. Dazzled by lore of the American dream, Chaya and her strange, brilliant young brother, Asher, stow away to Chicago. What they discover there, however, is a Gilded Age, as empty a facade as the beautiful Columbian Exposition luring thousands to Lake Michigan's shore. The pair scrapes together a meager living, Chaya in a cigar factory, Asher roaming the city and stealing books and jewelry to share with the poor, until they find different paths of escape. An examination of family, love, and revolution, this profound tale resonates eerily with today's current events and tumultuous social landscape. When I spoke with Rosellen Brown, I began by asking her if she thinks that immigrant stories like The Lake on Fire help to illuminate the current situation of immigrant stories unfolding in our country. Do people not see these parallels? I wondered to her, are they not getting their grandparents' and great-grandparents' stories the way we all used to? Our conversation went from there. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, that's an interesting question. I hadn't quite thought about it as, you know, straightforwardly. Is that part of the reason for that, I think, is that I apparently started thinking about this book one long time ago.
Yeah.
Long before our current immigrant, our displeasure with the presence of immigrants. I keep coming up with evidence, sort of accidentally finding old letters and things that I've written, telling me that I was thinking about this book back in, the latest one I found was 1987.
Wow.
Which was astonishing to me. Apparently I'd been talking about it with someone, and then I was already really thinking about it, and a little bit later and so on. So I was not at all consciously thinking about whether this, you know, had any bearing on what was then, you know, fairly quiet. And there have always been immigrants, but, you know, there was not the current crisis. So I really didn't think of it that way. Then again, given where we are right now, of course, I have to consider it. You know, whether or not I find it so difficult, I think. I don't even quite know how to approach this. I don't know that today's generation is as tuned in or even as curious about the immigration of their own families to the United States. I think that's so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the numbers, you know, that it's generations ago. I don't think there's too much curiosity on the part of young people. Maybe there is, but I think the problem is that the major, from my point of view, the major assault on immigration is not from those young people.
Right.
It's from older people who might know those stories and don't care because they feel somehow that their rights are being impeded and so on. And so it becomes it's a combination of an economic problem and the sense of too many differences, too many things are happening that are making our country different. And I think that's where the problem comes in. You know, that it's people speaking languages in my town that never were spoken before.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, how can we be demanding that everybody, you know, either understand Spanish or allow Spanish to go on? You know, all those things. I think that combines with things like the the changes of the lives of women and the demands that women have made and, you know, the loss of jobs, just so many things happening at one time. But I think that's what's, you know, making people impatient with the idea of immigration now. And so I don't know that stories like this really mean very much to people. I don't think they relate to those old stories very much because they have problems now and they're looking for somebody to blame. And if you can blame immigrants as well as all those uppity women and all the rest of them, we'll do that. You know, so I haven't really thought of the book as a polemic, but I've definitely seen that there are parallels. I mean, there's no question about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other part of the book, of course, that you took, I'm sure took notice of, is the whole question of economic inequities.
Yeah, yeah.
And so on. And that's certainly a part where I was very conscious of the fact that that relates so totally to where we are right now, where the difference between the people who are, you know, living the lovely life of the Gilded Age and then the people who are serving them or out of work or in Chicago's case and all around the country because there was a depression, dying in the streets, literally. That part certainly for me relates.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I thought a wonderful central piece of your book, which works as a metaphor, I think, for all of this coming together, is the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893, which I think we've gotten used to hearing the World's Fair, but that was the World's Fair that year, and it celebrated right. The 400th anniversary of Columbus landing on American shores. And you know, it's interesting because I think that was an event that was supposed to highlight American exceptionalism, but in the way that you've presented it, which I'm sure is very accurate, we get to see kind of the underside of what that looked like. And that also highlights differences in class and the wealth and poverty. And
right. Well, isn't it always the case that it's the people who are doing the serving, the
right.
building, you know, all the rest of it are unseen? At the moment in Chicago, there's a big hotel strike of hotel workers. Who want to be guaranteed that they will have insurance during the part of the year when they get laid off, because every year it's very seasonal. And so they get laid off and they lose their insurance. And what are they going to do? Those are the people that we don't see. They'll stay in a hotel and, you know,
right.
They're unseen. So I was very, very conscious of wanting to remind people of how that beautiful, you know, set of edifices was built. I also once had a very interesting conversation with someone. I was saying, God, you know, not only did they have to sort of fill in the swamps of the lake to make landfill, and
yeah.
Frederick Law Olmsted was designing this beautiful, beautiful place, but they did it and built these incredible buildings in a year, even though they weren't built to stand. They were still safe enough to walk into, you know,
right.
even though the outer layer was not permanent. And I said, they did it in about a year and a half. And this person said to me, yeah, and there were no OSHA rules at the time. You could have as many people as you wanted to building in the most unsafe ways. There were deaths among the workers who built the fair. But, you know, that's not something that we thought about.
Right.
I mean, no OSHA. Oh, gee, you know, the protection of workers hadn't occurred to anybody at the time because they were just the drones. They were the worker bees, and they put it together, and then they got out of sight.
Yeah.
So those are the people that I wanted, you know, to highlight. And then, of course, my Asher, my little guy who is so sensitive to the pain of these people who built this place. He gets a little out of hand, but you know, his heart is with them.
Yeah.
So we've got that. Sheila, you'll be very interested in knowing that this book did not start with the Columbian Exposition in it at all.
Oh, really? That is interesting.
When I go back to that beginning that I said where I started thinking about it back in the late 80s and into the early 90s, so it's really crazy to think about. Not that I've been working on it all this time. You understand I've published a couple books since then and
yeah,
did a
yeah.
lot of other writing, but I mean, this was, you know, but it was in progress. It started with the farm, the Jewish farmers who were brought from Russia to begin farms, even though they knew nothing about farming. It was kind of a crazy experiment.
Right, in Wisconsin.
And the entire book was set in New Hampshire.
Oh.
And I wish I could find the manuscript. God knows I save an awful lot of stuff in them when I want it. There's so much here that I can't find what I need. I'd love to see the early attempts. What was I filling a couple of hundred pages with when it was only the farm and drama and so on happening on the farm? But that's the way it began. And it was only after we moved to Chicago. We had been living in Houston and came to Chicago kind of accidentally and ended up staying. We happened to be living near the grounds where the exposition took place. We're just a couple blocks from there. And I was walking around one day, because every day I walk along the lake. In fact, this morning I'm putting that off so that I can talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
So it's worth it. Every day I would walk, and sometimes, occasionally, I would walk around basically where the exposition was. And I knew nothing about it when I came here. I think I had maybe vaguely heard of it. Many people have, but I didn't really know any details of it at all. And I'm walking behind the only building that still exists, which is now called the Museum of Science and Industry. It was made permanent, but it had been the kind of palace of fine arts during the exposition. And I'm walking behind it. They're beautiful. There's a big lagoon, and it's very beautifully sort of landscaped. And I'm thinking, my God, this incredible place was here, and nothing is left. There's one bridge. There's that one building. There's one bridge. And there may be a couple of lamps, street lamps. But other than that, nothing is left. So it's impossible to imagine what was there. And I have to say that it was not so much a fiction writer's metaphor in my mind, but a poet's, really, which was the kind of, it was there and it's gone, and we are here and we will be gone. Mm-hmm. It was one of those shattering moments of realization of how temporary everything is.
Yeah.
And how, looking at the history of it, it's impossible to imagine that there was that kind of life and the millions, literally millions of people who walked where I was walking, and none of it is left. The paths aren't even there anymore. Yeah. And that was when all my writing, and I think probably many writers would say the same thing, all my writing takes place when two things come together and there's a little, like a match that's lit.
Yeah.
And one of them isn't enough to do it. So there has to be the coming together of two ideas. And in this case, what kind of was inflamed for me suddenly was, oh my goodness, I could somehow make the farm craziness, the experiment of the failed farmers, and because they could be coming from Wisconsin. Now, you have to also understand, I'm teaching a course at the School of the Art Institute, where I teach, on writing about Chicago. One of the things we read is Sister Carrie. Well, to be honest, we read only part of it.
Okay.
Not too many people read it in high school anymore the way they used to, but Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie it was about a young girl, and I'm going to recite you a wonderful line from it, what I think of as the only good line in the book. It's a very interesting book, but it's very inelegantly written. And there's only one wonderful line in it that I found when I went over it looking for an epigraph for my book. Couldn't find one. But he has this farm girl, or she's a small town girl, getting on the train in Columbia City, Wisconsin, and coming to Chicago. And then here's what he says. I love this. When a girl leaves her home at 18, she does one of two things. Either she falls into saving hands and becomes better, or she rapidly assumes the cosmopolitan standard of virtue and becomes worse. And one of the only classically balanced lines in the book, which is why it's so beautiful. But what happens to Carrie is that she becomes first a showgirl, and then not exactly a prostitute, but something close to it. And she brings a couple of men to their ruin, and she's really not living what would be called a moral life. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what if I move the farm to Wisconsin? And I actually, this is a little in-joke, nobody is going to recognize it. I actually have her get on the train one town away from where they're living, which is the same town that Sister Carrie gets on the train in Columbia City. No, nobody's going to know that but me, but it gave me pleasure. As she gets on the train and her wildly intelligent and weird little brother has kind of stowed away and come with her.
Yeah.
She does not invite him. She hates leaving him behind, but he is not going to be left behind. So he shows up and they get on the train together. And this is my version of what could happen to Sister Carrie if, in fact, she did not become worse by adopting the cosmopolitan standards of virtue of the big city, but becomes better.
Right. As I was reading it, it occurred to me that Asher finding her, I'm not going to go into great detail about what happened, partly because I don't want to give it away, but you said, he sort of stows away with her, and she originally is going to leave on her own. And the fact that he comes with her, I think, probably changes the course of what could have happened to her. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely,
that was interesting to me. I have a couple of lines from your book that I want to mention to you and talk about.
Okay.
One is, this was a great line because it had to do with the book itself, but it made me think about writing. You have this line, beginnings are more than beginnings. They make the next things happen the way they do. And I thought, wow, that's such great writing advice too. And I wondered if we can talk about beginnings.
This week, it's so interesting that you pulled that out, because this week I've just started class 2 weeks ago, and I'm doing a class on imitations, in which I'm trying to push people out of their comfort zones,
if
they have them, graduate students, these are, to try to get them to write in ways very different from theirs. And this week, I read to them in class a wonderful essay. I don't know if you know this essay by Clark Blaze called To Begin, To Begin.
No.
Which is about the difficulty but the importance of beginnings. And then I pulled out of my files in 1995, Poets and Writers asked me to do something to celebrate their 25th anniversary. And I, and also the writer Clarence Major, came up with 25 opening lines that we really liked.
Oh.
And so this week I have my class reading those, reading something else about about good writing, and then coming up with their own good lines. And there, do you know this wonderful, there's a wonderful website called S for Sentence.
No.
The novelist Pearl Abraham every month has a writer pick a sentence, probably from the beginning, not necessarily the first line, but something significant as a sentence, and analyze why it's such a wonderful sentence.
Oh, cool.
And so this week I have them coming in with 5 or 10 wonderful opening lines of stories or novels, and being prepared to tell us why they think those lines work the way they do. So you picked the perfect thing to talk about, because I've actually wrote an essay once about what you need to know by the time you get to the end of the first page of a story.
Oh.
I was specifically talking about stories because they really are different from novels.
Yeah.
I have a memory once of a workshop that John Gardner did at Breadloaf.
Uh-huh.
I was teaching in the first year I taught at Breadloaf. He gave a workshop on, I can't remember what it was, whether it was about the difference between stories and novels or what it was. But anyway, he had us looking at openings of the two and seeing what the differences are. And of course, you have to be pitched so quickly into a story that by the time you get to the end of the first paragraph, there are so many things you need to know. You need to be, prepared to answer who's talking, who's the person talking to, why, where, all of those, the 5 W's that journalism students have to learn.
Right.
You have to have a sense of the tone of things. I mean, by the end of the first page of my book, for example, that there's at the beginning, at least, a slightly tale-like quality about this, right? It's being told from a distance initially. It gets much closer in, but the beginning, it's really rather formal.
Yeah.
And you sort of know this is not going to be a book that's going to read like, I don't know what, whoever you want to think about of contemporary writing. It's going to be rather different from that. Some long sentences, complex sentences, we're off in a very particular direction, and in a story that has happened even sooner. So I love thinking about beginnings, and as Clark Blaze says in his wonderful essay, I can send that to you. It's online, actually. Look up Clark Blaze.
I will.
And Blaise.
Okay. I'll link it on my podcast site.
Link it. Yes, it's called To Begin, To Begin. And it is just, he has some examples of beginnings of stories that are so marvelous. You just, you look at them and you can, if you take this phrase out, the sentence collapses you know, this is why you need these words, or there's a long, long, dreary sentence by Chekhov, which is exactly a mnemonic for what it is that he's talking about.
Oh, wow.
How the weather will not change. And it's just a beautiful essay, and I have read it aloud. People can read it to themselves, but I've loved reading it aloud to students because they can savor those sentences when they hear them. And so, yes, you absolutely picked out something that's of tremendous importance to
okay,
me.
Okay, great.
And I do begin it. I remember a friend saying once, and this didn't have anything to do with writing either, Sheila. It had to do with beginning a job. And he said the way something begins is often, or it was the beginning of a project, something like that, unrelated to writing. But the way things begin very often have in them the seeds of what is going to happen later.
Yeah.
Not always, but very, very often those seeds are there. And so I take that very seriously. So you picked out something so central for me.
But I think sometimes it's easy to pick out what's central to authors because it's right there on the page.
You know? It's really clear what
matters to you.
I need a magnifying glass.
So then, and the other thing I was going to read and ask you about, I just loved this. So first of all, I'll just mention that the narrative point of view moves back and forth between Chaya and Asher, the brother and sister, the sister and brother. I love the two types of stars that help us ground ourselves at the beginning of each chapter, because we aren't always alternating in turn. It doesn't go Chaya, Asher, Chaya, Asher, Chaya, Asher.
Right.
For example, at the beginning of the book, there are several chapters that are all Chaya, and so we think it's all going to be her narrative. And then you do this amazing thing, which I loved. So as you've said, Asher is a very curious, precocious little boy. And Chicago really excites him, and he's just bouncing off the walls. And we learn that from Chaya in her chapters. But then his first narrative point of view chapter, the first sentence is, Asher came to consciousness in a single blow. And I was like, oh my God, that's so perfect, because yes, he's coming to consciousness because Chicago wakes him up, but also he's coming into our consciousness because this is his first point of view chapter, and he is, boom, all of a sudden he's just right there in front of us. And then ultimately, you know, this is also true of what will motivate him as he changes and grows, and consciousness takes on greater meaning in his story as he, you know, learns about human nature and social consciousness. I just thought that sentence was so fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I really desperately needed, you know, a kind of a break from her point of view and from the language used for her, so that his is much more immediate and full of sensory observation.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, as you know, there's a lot of wordplay, or at least he's learning the language, and he's bewildered. And he actually talks about the word bewildered. What is be? Wilder? What is it?
Yeah.
And he sort of interrogates a lot of words. And I should tell you this. I just learned last week that there's going to be an audio version of the book. And I'm thinking to myself, how are they going to deal with that? With some of the word questions, but my husband said, look, they recorded Ulysses, they can manage your book. You know? somebody will figure out how to do it. But he spends a lot of time kind of turning words over in his head.
Yes.
Some of them turn out to be kind of punning and, you know, things that I would never even have thought about. But then when I'm trying to think about some of the examples, when you pull back and say, well, gee, if you don't know the language, you know, does this make sense, or why is it, what is it? I'm looking at you, the book.
I know the one that comes to me, and this isn't necessarily as language oriented, but I loved this moment for him where he's thinking about clapping, and he's like, who started that? Where does it come from? Do people in Africa clap? Who claps? It was so great. He's just so curious.
We've kind of forgotten to ask these questions.
Right.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, one of the wonderful things about novels is you get a lot of stuff out that's in your own head.
Yes.
You can find somebody to own it and ask it or tell it for you. You know, lots of little impressions that you have that you have no place for. They can show up in your novel.
Yeah.
It's a chance to work those out. So again, I wish I could think of, or, you know, here's one thing that I just happened to open up arbitrarily. This is actually not even Asha. This is Chaya. She's talking to Gregory, the man that she's falling in love with. and says Gregory, she had discovered, was truly his family's odd man out. He had trained in the law but refused to practice it. His father and his brother Ned were with a bank and in manufacturing, he told her. Those prepositions peculiarly vague, as if there were something nefarious to hide about such connections. In, with, whoever thought about, but
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
You do say, I'm in one and I'm with the other.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, that's,
so it's sort of snap,
yeah. And
you know,
I was,
the whole idea that people who don't speak the language naturally are going to have a very different relation to it than we do.
Right. And particularly, I think English is very hard in that way when you're coming from another language. But I did have a question for you about using a foreign language in the background of a novel, using actual foreign words to evoke what those characters naturally are thinking, and how much is too much, and how much do you think adds to the overall sense of things? Do you have thoughts about that?
I think in general, there's not a lot of it in this book, and you sort of can definitely figure out what's being said. It's not quite as much as, say, Junot Diaz, who throws a lot of Spanish, Dominican Spanish into his sentences, and he doesn't bother to translate long and complicated things. We don't really care because you've got the context,
yeah.
And I think it's just fine, you know, to sort of remind people that there is underneath all of this is another rhythm going, you know, there's another music happening. And with Diaz, it sometimes, you know, you do have to sit and ponder, what is it that I've just read? I'm reading right now a wonderful book by my own editor, actually, Sarah Gorham at Sarabande Books. When she was 15, went to Switzerland for a couple of years to get her out of the American high school system, which she was being bullied and made miserable. And her parents sent her to Switzerland. And there's German from time to time that some of it is translated and some of it is not. And she has a great deal to say about the language, you know, about learning German. But from time to time, there are things that don't get translated. So, you know, if you're smart enough to be reading the book, you can figure this stuff out from context. So I've thrown in a few. You know, my own knowledge of Yiddish is quite limited. When I was a very little girl, my grandmother lived with us for a number of years. And my mother used to tell me that when I was in my high chair, she and my grandmother would speak Yiddish and I couldn't understand it. And I would get really angry and jabber at them so that it sounded like I was trying to speak Yiddish, but I wasn't. I was sort of, you know, trying to break into the conversation. But I don't know much more than, you know, most, many, many American Jews of, you know, later generations don't really know a lot. But, you know, I've thrown a few things in there. Day of that, go away. I heard that all the time when I was a kid.
Right.
But there's not enough. There's not enough to bewilder anybody. But I do want people to remember, you know, that, and I'm not even sure I made enough of this. I'm in that stage right now, just before the book comes out, where I'm asking myself where my shortfalls were, what didn't I do enough of? And one of the things is that I'm not sure that I actually had enough about memories of back before, you know, back in the, quote, old country.
Mm.
And, you know, and I, at one point, Gregory discovers Faya when she's pregnant. Giving something away there, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Leaning down over her belly and singing in Yiddish to her child.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of those moments when I did remember that that's the mother tongue after all, you know.
Yeah.
That was the original language. And by the way, if anybody wonders whether it's probable that Faya would learn as English as well as she does, there was a book by Mary Antin, A-N-T-I-N, a wonderful book called The Promised Land. She was an immigrant also from Eastern Europe, probably from Russia, I don't remember. And she comes to the United States and very quickly assimilates so much. And later she, in fact, converts to Christianity and so on. She goes to Radcliffe. But she learns language so fast. Chaya is a little bit late to learn it quite as fast as she does, but it absolutely can be done. So the Mary Antin book is beautifully written. There's another one, and this is somewhere lurking behind my story. There is a story of a woman named Rose Pastor Stokes, who, like Chaya, she works in a cigar factory, and I actually forgot that that's where she worked when she came to this country.
Mm.
And she marries a very, very wealthy man, and they are socialists together for a while until she goes off far to the left, and he gives up on all of that and ends up condemning her, and they divorce, and it's complicated. But she was in the back of my mind, this whole idea of the sort of Cinderella wedding, and so on.
And what's the name of that
she
book?
Too, the name, well, the, she wrote an autobiography. She wrote a lot of things. She wrote a play. She wrote poetry. And I actually found some of it in the library, university library. You won't find it in your local library. But she wrote a book called I Belong to the Working Class, the unfinished autobiography of Rose Pastor Stokes. And she became a very, very wonderful speaker on behalf of women's rights and the rights of the people. She was actually became one of the founders of the American Communist Party. But she learned English very, very well and became a journalist, really, after she wrote a letter to a newspaper, you know, lauding the rights of the people to stand up against their capitalist, you know, the perpetrators of all the horrors of capitalism.
Yeah.
And she writes beautifully. So, you know, these people were perfectly capable of learning English.
Well, plus, Kaya and Asher are very young, you know, and I mean, when we're young, we are much more able to take in new language, I think.
Yes, right. And of course, they're living a very assimilated life. The parents do not learn English that way because they're living with each other. And that's exactly what we see right now, in fact.
I don't want to have our time get away without my mentioning your incredible, beautiful prose and the details that you offer. I was just blown away because the details really helped me be in the moment, every moment. But it wasn't too much. It wasn't too much. You know, I think sometimes when you're doing historical writing and you're doing a lot of research, it's hard to kind of cut out what will be, you know, too much, and you never had that. But I do want to mention offering detail at the right time and in the right way. And one example that I found on it, when they flee from Wisconsin and run away to Chicago, there's this wonderful scene where they're on the train. So first, when they first board the train, Chaya's too exhausted to notice anything. And so she just kind of goes to sleep and zones out and collapses. But then when they're about to disembark in Chicago, they're delayed. There's like a delay in getting off the train, which was entirely believable. Yeah. That sort of thing happens all the time.
It happens every time, yes.
Right. And this is when she notices her surroundings, when she's awake and trapped. It was perfect. Do you mind if I read a little tiny bit?
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love it. I'd love to hear it.
Okay, so this is from that moment. They're on the train, and this is your paragraph. They weren't moving. If only to contain her apprehension, she made herself concentrate on everything she saw. The shiny brown valise that sat on its own seat, upright like a child, the pull-down shade rolled up at her window, the gay checkered suit jacket of the portly man across the aisle, complete with a carefully folded handkerchief in the breast pocket, which matched the dark green of the plaid, but which, though he was perspiring in the stilled train, he did not use. That was so great.
I don't remember. I mean, I remember the scene, but thank you. It's lovely.
It is lovely.
I enjoy listening to that audio book when it finally comes.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, because those are the things. Well, you know, one of the things that I've always said to my students, and I actually use an example from one of my books, is that one of the great pleasures of writing is to immerse yourself in those details. I'm hardly the first person to have said that. Nabokov famously said, caress the details.
Mm.
But, you know, you need to sort of try to imagine yourself. I sometimes find myself watching someone, say, eating a piece of pizza or something, I don't know, whatever, and kind of saying in my mind, kind of like trying to rehearse what that feels like.
Yeah.
Trying to sort of kind of get into the head of somebody. So one of the examples that I've often used is I wrote a book called Tender Mercies about a woman who becomes a quadriplegic in an accident that's caused by her husband. That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
And in the book, at some point, at the very beginning of the book, she's come home from a rehabilitation institute, she's not really ready for that. He's not ready. The husband is not ready for it. He's kind of stolen her out of there ahead of time without much idea of how to deal with someone in her situation. And he puts her down on the couch and when they're coming into the house and leaves her for a minute to go back to the car to get her wheelchair without thinking that, of course, this woman has no muscle power at all and she can't sit up.
Right.
And she falls forward. And I was, the book is set in a house that we lived in. It was in New Hampshire. It was a very, very old, it was a 200-year-old farmhouse. And we had those very wide floorboards with little spaces between them.
Right, you know, sure.
Really old boards. And what I did when I wrote that scene was I sat on the couch and I flopped forward. And I said to myself, what do I see? And what I saw, which is kind of appalling, was that there was a lot of dust between the floorboards and a bobby pin and a penny and a couple of other things that I just assumed not have seen. But then I wrote it into the book because I actually, you know, made myself, and you can't do this with every detail, obviously, but I made myself observe every detail that she would have seen. And so I say to my students, you know, you've got to enjoy that. I have another memory of writing in a scene because I knew I needed it. The book was near completion. And I said, oh, I need one more, something like this. And this is my book, Civil Wars, which is set in Mississippi. You can see I've moved around a lot.
Yeah.
Kind of a peripatetic writer. And I bring my woman, who is a New Yorker, to one of those Sunday afternoon pig outs that Mississippians are used to, where they go to a restaurant where there's a big Lazy Susan that goes around featuring all the famous food of the South, the fried chicken and the, you know, the jewel colored jello and,
right,
you know, all the rest of it, the hush puppies. And I just enjoyed, I remember I felt like I had just jumped into a vat of something wonderful filling, just saying, what did it look like? What did it feel like, smell like, taste like? And I think it's something that, especially because students very often these days feel the need to make everything clipped and minimalist and,
yes,
you know, just down to the bone, and they don't enjoy what the flesh on the bone feels like,
yeah,
to write.
Yeah.
And it's such a pleasure, and they just deny themselves that pleasure.
And I'll just add to something you said a second ago, which is you can't possibly describe every moment in that kind of detail, but you don't need
no.
to, because if you have the right moments described in that kind of detail, then the whole world fills in for the rest of the story.
Right, right, exactly,
yeah,
exactly. You know, and there are, you know, some of the little things, like there's another language thing, going back to the question of learning language, when Gregory brings a beautiful dress for her to wear when
uh-huh.
she's going to meet his parents. It's magenta. And she thinks, oh, it sounds like the name of a South American country. You know, not something that we tend to think in ordinary life. It's one of the pleasures of the writing.
Yeah.
You know, you have to keep yourself amused
yeah.
while you're doing this. So thank you, though, for telling me that there's not too much detail. You know, I've always felt as if, from the very first novel that I wrote, the autobiography of my mother, I felt like the research that I do is not the kind that you write down much of the time. It's what you absorb and what of it you remember. That's the important stuff.
Okay.
The stuff that you need is what you remember. And I have nothing against the kind where you write things down. I certainly have to try to remember certain things. It would probably skip my mind. But a lot of it really should be, how is the atmosphere getting to you? You know, how are those, what's the accretion of those details? And then you can go back and sort of peel them away one by one.
Yeah.
But not overdoing it. One of the reasons I think that we tend to over-research is not only that it's, you know, it's just hard to give up any of that, but frankly, Shayla, it's just much easier than writing. You know, you're reading the work somebody else has done. There's nothing harder than saying, I'm putting that aside and saying, okay, I'm done with that. Now I'm going to write.
Yeah.
Because you have that empty page in front of you or that empty screen, however you write. And, of course, in the case of the exposition, there were a huge number, or there are a huge number of books, you know, of photographs available.
Yeah.
And so I was able to use a lot of that. And one very moving moment, the Field Museum, which is the anthropology museum here, did a beautiful exhibit about the exposition. And not only did it have a lot of the things that people were seeing for the first time, and I sometimes wonder if I skimped on those a little bit. That's one of the things I'm down on myself about. I'm not sure I gave enough credit to the fact that people were seeing things that they'd never seen before. We, you know, these days have the capacity to see everything. We don't see large movements of, you know, poor people or whatever, but we definitely can see the bones of a bat if we want to,
mm-hmm.
you know, by just tuning it in on our, you know, on our screen. And people had not seen anything like that at the time. But one of the things that they had was a short film in which there were live people. It was just a kind of a little jokey thing in which somebody is chasing someone else and a third person gets involved and so on. But I was so moved to look at it and say, it was back to my original moment of apprehending that none of this is there anymore.
Yeah.
None of these people are alive anymore.
Yeah.
And I was looking at those people and saying, they were there. They were in this place, and they're all gone now.
Isn't that interesting?
And it was really, really moving.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful exhibit.
Yeah.
And, of course, Chicago is more devoted to those than any other place. You know, everybody I know who's from Chicago has a great-grandmother who came from someplace, some farm somewhere, with a little silver souvenir spoon or a handkerchief. Or some, there are just souvenirs floating around everywhere in Chicago because every family sent somebody, you know, to see it.
To see it.
And a lot of them were, again, out, you know, they were seeing, everybody was seeing things, a lot of people seeing electricity for the first time.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what that would be like?
Yeah. Yeah.
The rich already had it, you know, in small numbers, and it was dim. But other people coming in, you know. I know somebody in New Hampshire who got electricity on her farm in 1956.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, you know, imagine what it was like in 1893. It was just, it was heavenly.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, my character is fighting against it the whole time while she rails against the beauty of this place, which is not available to most people most of the time. She's enjoying it, you know.
Right.
And she goes back to look at a very famous, and this is real, a very famous painting of a young man leaving his family, leaving his farm to go to the big city, which of course was happening all over the country.
Yeah.
It was happening in New Hampshire, and it was happening, you know, everywhere where the kids were leaving and they were showing up in the mills or the, you know, the industrial places. So it was a very central, it was really the most popular painting of the entire exhibit because it so exemplified the life of so many people looking at it who were first generation Chicagoans or farm people coming in from elsewhere.
Yeah. So I wondered, Rosellen, what you've been reading lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Oh, yes, yes. You said you were going to ask me. I have a book, one book. I'm not going to recommend a lot of things. But one book which didn't get a lot of attention and I thought deserved it. Do you read Alice McDermott?
Yes.
She's a wonderful, wonderful writer. Her work is all about the Catholic world.
Yeah.
And typically, I believe Mary Gordon reviewed the book for the Times, which would be typical because, you know, they always have their go-to people.
Yes.
For various things. If I get a review in the Times, and who knows if I will, I'm curious about who their go-to person would be for this book.
Yeah.
But in her case, the book, it's called The Ninth Hour. Which I believe refers to the hour after, oh God, I don't even remember, don't know Catholicism well enough to know what the prayers are of the day. But anyway, this is the last thing when everything else is over with. But it's a very beautiful book. Alice McDermott, there was a piece of it in The New Yorker, which is where I found it originally and decided to pursue the book.
Mm.
So many times they have something that's actually an excerpt that stands alone from a novel. And it's about the part that was in The New Yorker, the beginning of the book, which is about a young man in Brooklyn, Irish, probably not an immigrant, but an Irish, you know, part of the very profoundly Irish community, who loses his job working on the subway and almost casually kills himself.
Oh.
He stuffs something under the door of their apartment. He's married, newly married, and turns on the gas and dies. And his young wife comes home and discovers him. And there is a nun who, in very kind fashion, and that's a word that I would use for all of McDermott's work, is kind, kindly nun who hides this and tries desperately to get the young man buried in sanctified ground, which of course is not supposed to happen to a suicide.
Right.
But the book then goes on into the next generation. It's the daughter of the wife who discovers, you know, the young man who's killed himself. So it's his daughter, basically, and the book goes on into that. And it's a great deal about being a nun or wanting to be a nun and, you know, many, many details. But what distinguishes McDermott's work for me always is that she has this sort of kindness. That's the only word I can think of. A loving kindness between so many of her characters who sometimes live harsh lives, but there's always she seeks a way for people to be forgiving. And that book for me is just a beautiful sort of exemplar of that. So I recommend it. And again, it didn't get a lot of attention when it came out.
Yeah. I think the only thing of hers that I've read is Charming Billy. I think that's,
yes, right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember her very first book, which is called That Night. And it was about a pitched battle in the suburbs between the young guys and I think the boyfriends of the girls in the neighborhood and the fathers who are trying to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember it terribly well, but it's quite brief. It's almost a novella, but it's really a very interesting book.
Yeah.
And it goes way, way back. So that's something that I would recommend.
Okay,
to
great.
People. And I don't read as much as I might hope because I'm a very, very slow reader. I'm in a book group, so we always, you know, read what they're reading, what everybody else is reading. And I don't really get through a lot. It's terrible.
I'm a very slow reader too.
You really? It's not an attentive. Doesn't everybody always says, "Oh, you must be so attentive"? No, I think slow readers are distracted readers.
Maybe. Yeah. I think because of the show, I read a lot faster than I used to because I have to.
You have to, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I need something like that. Well, I have to do it for school, of course.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
But then again, if I don't get past the opening line, I don't have a lot to read. My assignment this week, I don't have to read any deeper into the story than the opening page.
Let's see. Now, I wanted to ask if you've started writing anything next, any new book, or if you're taking a break.
No, I haven't. I've been working on, and I don't know that I'm going to go on with it. I think I'm not, probably, is that I've been writing for years another book that, this book's been in and out of my, I can't tell you how many times, in and out of my desk drawer as I've lost faith in it and thought, oh, who's going to care about this? And, you know, can I possibly sustain this? And it's had a checkered past with me. But in the meantime, I've been working and just probably putting away now a sequel to my book, Tender Mercies. I really liked that book.
Oh, yeah.
The one about the woman who becomes a quadriplegic.
Yes.
And it's also a two-part book where she speaks in italics, a very kind of poeticized prose, and the rest of it is very coolly over the shoulder of her husband. Had to be cool because it's a very kind of a sentimental topic if you aren't careful. So I got that voice very quickly, and it was very cool. But what I've been doing is bringing her up to date 30 years later after she becomes a quadriplegic and lives a quite productive life, but is ready to die because she's just had enough and her body is kind of giving out on her. And someone in the family has to help her with that, which is a much discussed topic, of course,
yes.
These days.
Yes.
And so there's a question of whether her husband or her daughter, with whom she's had a very kind of complicated relationship, are going to help her. They don't actually kill her, but they bring her to the place where she takes her wheelchair off the edge of a dock into deep water.
Well, don't tell us.
She was injured in deep water. Well, I don't know if I'm going to go on with it. One of the battles that I fought and lost quite a while ago was I was hoping that I thought that the book would have a lot more emotional valence, I guess you could call it, if I had, just as with my books, Cora Fry, which was published in 1977, and Cora Fry's Pillow book, which was published in the early 90s, they were published together back-to-back by Sarah Strauss. I was hoping that somebody would do the first book and the second book as book one and two together. They're not that long. Because for you to care about this woman, you know, it would have been wonderful mm-hmm. to have seen her in her early days coping. Her whole family has to cope with this terrible thing that's happened to her. And it was very difficult to get it started from ground zero if I had to do the whole thing, you know, for the sequel.
Yeah.
And I don't think we give that much of a damn about her, frankly, because we haven't seen what she's gone through to get here. And I couldn't get a single publishing professional to agree that that would be a good thing to do. They just said, oh, let people buy the other book first and read it. Go to the library, whatever, you know. And I just felt like that was wrong. So therefore, that one went in and out of my desk drawer. And I've just taken it out. And I just, without the first book, I just don't think I can make it emotionally, you know, sort of potent enough.
Hmm.
I may be wrong. I don't know. The other thing is, I frankly, I'm just tired of getting up to a story that ends in death. These days, I think we need something more cheerful. But I do have to admit something, which is a little hard to admit. But I must say that when I kind of resuscitated this book and went back to work on it, I was very relieved not to be writing about the current. I'm not just talking about the political times, but I think I'm really afraid to try to write about this generation.
Mm.
I am afraid, frankly, that I can't get into the head of current young people. I don't think I can do it without doing a kind of ventriloquial act that just would give myself away at every corner, you know?
Oh, I don't know. I think if you
can't speak this language.
I think if you have the right readers, yep. if you have the right readers, don't you think they could help you sort of, I mean.
They'd all be my age. Yeah, they'd all be my age.
Oh.
The people who read the book would be my age. I mean, I don't live on my devices, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, I watch my students who just have their heads down in their phones all the time. And, you know, I don't do that as it is. I think I check my email too many times a day, but I'm certainly not living on my phone.
Yeah.
Or the idea of driving while, you know, 50% of young people drive on there and text at the same time.
Oh, yeah, Jerry, well, just, my husband just told me this morning he read 1 in 3 is texting while driving.
Well,
yeah,
I heard 1 in 2.
1 in 2, you know, wow.
I can't enter that world. So whatever it is that I'm going to write next, and I'm not sure what it could be. I wish I could write some stories. I really love stories much more than novels, actually. I think they're much closer to poetry than they are to a novel. But I don't have any in my head, and I think I'm going to reach back. Who knows, I may do more historical stuff.
Because you brought up the subject of euthanasia, you kind of lead nicely into my next question, which is, you know, you write in this book about wealth and poverty and social consciousness without lecturing your readers. And I feel like sometimes books that are trying to make a statement about something, and maybe euthanasia is another subject that would be that kind of thing, you know, they do lecture, but you don't. You just sort of make the subject a fundamental part of the story that we're interested in. So I wonder if in closing you have any advice for writers for how to approach important subjects in a book of fiction without lecturing.
Well, I think you need to, you said it, you need to embody the challenges that your characters have in their lives. So I look at this book really in one way of looking at it. You know, sometimes I say, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, the Gilded Age, you know, as a subject. But on the other hand, it's really a question of how do I live my life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting that I asked Meg Wolitzer to do the quote on the back
of
it.
Yeah, that was great.
She's a friend. And all of her books really, in many ways, ask the question, you know, how, I mean, I don't know if you've read her latest one, The Female Persuasion. And it's yet another book, not her first, about a young woman coming of age during the sort of birth of feminism, of contemporary feminism or second wave feminism or whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
And trying to figure out how is she going to sort of, you know, ford the waters, you know, into her life and what is she going to devote herself to and what is important and what would constitute being a sellout and so on. And so for me, the way to approach this big divide that I was looking at was to say my young woman, Chaya, and Asher as well, are trying to figure out, you know, how do I live a good life? And that goes back to that crazy quote from Theodore Dreiser and
right.
Sister Carrie.
Right, right.
She comes to the city, and is she going to fall? And some of it is chance. Whose hands does she fall into? And in this case, it really is chance because, of course, Chaya meets this man whom she's going to fall in love with
right.
in the first minutes from, you know, coming off the platform
right.
to the station, arriving. But, you know, what kind of, which path are you going to take now that you're in the big city? Are you, you know, are you going to go toward the flesh pots or are you going to try to be, you know, sort of, you know, a leader or an exemplar or at least conscious of, you know, and in her case, she's plunged into this because she's so poor.
Right,
she
but
no
she's
choice.
She's so smart because what she does is she says, I want to find my community. And that is, of course, the smarter
yeah.
choice.
And then she wonders, am I going to betray my class
yeah.
if I let myself love this man? And he is trying to betray his class because he's disgusted at the idea that he comes from a wealthy family and wishes that they, you know, use their money differently. And so for them, it really does become a question, both of them. And they do it differently because he's coming from a different path. And she keeps asking the question, can a man who's raised with the kind of background that he has, can he possibly understand people who've come from my background? And it's interesting, Sheila, you know, one of the epigraphs of this book is from Brecht, who, of course, was very, you know, very involved in class matters. And I didn't know that the way I used it was completely opposite of what he intended.
Oh.
My epigraph reads, I carry a brick on my shoulder in order that the world may know what my house was like. And I thought of that as a kind of negative. Some people would say, leave it to me to always be on the negative side. But it was more, not really negative, but it was sort of like, I want you to notice, you know, what I come from. And I'm not very eagerly and willingly going to give it up to run into the arms of wealth. But in fact, apparently what he meant, if I've gone on with the poem, was I just wanted you to know what my background was. And he wasn't necessarily, I don't think he was poor growing up. He was not necessarily making a point of what it was like to be poor, but that was somehow useful to me the way I read it.
Yeah. Well, and you can pull the line out and use it to your advantage.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I did. But anyway, so it really, I hesitate to use the word, the fancy word, Bildungsroman, but that is what was the German for a novel about growing up and figuring out how to live.
Yeah.
And that really, in many ways, is one of the things that pleased me was I just saw book list gave it a very lovely review. And then there was just a sort of what they call a pull quote the other day. It was a review of the day, and they simplified it down to sort of one long sentence. And one of them was that it was character driven. And I thought, yes, you know, it could be one of the conversations that I'm going to have in one of the bookstores in Chicago is with a friend who wrote a book about one of John Singer Sargent's paintings of a beautiful woman, you know, Gilded Age woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that night we'll talk a lot about the Gilded Age, but I didn't want to simply rail at it. I wanted to show it and show what it felt like to find yourself part of it. And of course, always, if you have the other as your main character, she's going to see it from without. And you know the old joke about the fish, you know, in the fish tank, don't have any idea that they're in water.
Yes, right.
In it. I mess up the joke if I try to tell it, but if you're in it, you don't see it. If you're not in it, you're the perfect surrogate for the audience. And so the advice that I guess I would have for writers is to embed your questions in the lives of your characters and have them ask the questions. Uh-huh. And don't leave them room to rail at you. The only railing that goes on in the book is when Usher goes to the place where the picketers and the angry union men
right.
are hanging out.
Right.
And he doesn't know the difference between socialist and anarchist and who's a proletarian anyway, is that me? But he too, he's bewildered and he's trying to figure it out. And so I quote a bit of their language, but you know, it's embedded. He's trying to figure out right. what in that world is this anyway.
Right. And that's believable dialogue. So that's different than you railing at the reader. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So the name of the book is The Lake on Fire, a novel by Rose Ellen Brown and published by Saraband. The book comes out October 16th. So, Rose Ellen, I want to thank you so much for being on Write the Book today.
Well, I've been so delighted to talk to you. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Rose Ellen Brown. You can learn more about her work at roseellenbrown.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest on today's show, Rose Ellen Brown. Use questions and answers. She has found this an intriguing way to write. She offers the Mark Strand poem Elegy for My Father as an example, and I will link that on the podcast site. In the poem, Strand poses a question to his father and is given an inadequate or dishonest answer, and so he asks the question again to receive a more honest answer. He does this several times with many different questions. Rose Ellen herself used a questionnaire to format a story in her collection, Street Games, offering both standard questions like name and address, but also crazy questions like, have you ever wished to die at the height of the sex act? She has found it very fruitful to tell students to use questions and answers in their writing. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.